This is Radio Times in Review. Thanks for joining us. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. The continuing outpouring of emotion taking place in Baltimore is the latest reminder of life in poor urban neighborhoods. While the trigger for these events was the death of Freddie Gray, the palpable frustration stems from more deep-seated problems, the criminalization of poverty. So we decided to play an excerpt of my interview with legal scholar and civil rights litigator Michelle Alexander. Her seminal book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, examines the beginnings of America's long-running war on drugs. She explains how it has resulted in unprecedented incarceration levels and a strained relationship between communities and police. She joined me back in 2010 to discuss the book, the drug war, and the legislation that has created what she calls America's caste system. Let's listen. Going back to the war on drugs, which I guess went into effect under Ronald Reagan, but certainly grew out of the Nixon administration, was the intention to target African Americans, or has that been the result?
Well, the intention from the outset was to exploit racial divisions and anxieties that were existing in our society and created a ripe opportunity for politicians to capitalize upon. Many people believe that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities, but that's not the case. The current drug war was declared by President Ronald Reagan in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. It was declared in an effort to make good on campaign promises that Reagan had made to get tough on a group of people who had not so subtly been defined in the media and political discourse as black and brown. Pollsters and Republican Party strategists found that by using get tough rhetoric on issues of crime and welfare, that they could appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were anxious about, threatened by, and resentful of many of the gains of the civil rights movement. By using this get tough rhetoric, they found that they could get those folks to defect from the Democratic Party, the Democratic New Deal coalition, and join the Republican Party in droves. It was part of the so-called Southern strategy of trying to flip the South from blue to red.
In fact, you quote H.R. Haldeman, part of the Nixon administration, in a sense, talking about how to target African Americans.
That's right. H.R. Haldeman described the strategy as, quote, "the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. You know, they declared a drug war at a time when drug crime was on the decline and at a time when most Americans weren't particularly concerned about drug crime in their communities. But they got lucky. And a couple years after the drug war was declared, crack hit the streets, first in Los Angeles, and spread to other urban areas across America. And the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, the so-called crack whores, and crack-related violence. They fed these stories to the media as part of a campaign to bolster public support for the drug war in the hopes of turning it into a media sensation and guaranteeing that Congress would send millions more dollars to state and local law enforcement agencies to wage it. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, our television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug users and dealers, forever changing the public conception of who drug users and dealers are. And a wave of punitiveness swept over the United States, resulting in harsh mandatory minimum sentences for relatively minor drug offenses. And soon Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them, the dark-skinned others.
Well, in fact, you include President Bill Clinton in your list of people that were part of this process of getting tough on drugs, but also getting tough on blacks as well, as sort of being part of this whole system.
Absolutely. President Bill Clinton, in an effort to win back those so-called white swing voters, the Reagan Democrats, escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. President Clinton presided over the greatest increase in black incarceration in our nation's history, and it was the Clinton administration that championed the laws barring drug offenders from public housing, denying them even food stamps for the rest of their lives. lives. To a large extent, our nation's new racial undercast can be traceable to the Clinton administration's escalation of the drug war and the laws that were passed.
In fact, you use the word caste in this book in a very specific kind of way, not to be confused with class. What do you mean by caste?
I call this a caste system because once you've been branded, once you've been swept into this system, you are ushered into a parallel social universe. You are rendered a second-class status for life. You're stripped of many of the rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement, like often the right to vote, the right to serve on juries, the right to be free from discrimination in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination we supposedly left behind are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon.
And we're talking about once you serve time in prison, then you are a felon.
Yes, but you don't even have to serve time. Many people who get just probation find themselves ushered into the second class status for the rest of their lives. Once you get that felon label, you have to check that box on employment applications for the rest of your life, asking, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And it doesn't matter if that felony happened 3 weeks ago or 35 years ago. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box, knowing full well that the odds are sky high that that application is going straight to the trash. In fact, even arrest records are used to discriminate against people and access to public housing in the United States. So you can be convicted of a minor felony or perhaps not even a felony, a lesser offense, and find that your criminal record follows you for the rest of your life, authorizing discrimination against you in virtually every aspect of political, social, and economic life.
But I'm thinking about a city like Philadelphia, which has a black police commissioner, a black mayor. Many members of city council are also African American, and this is I'm not sure exactly what the number are, but about 50% black city. Does your thesis implicate them as well?
Absolutely. What the Reagan administration, and actually began with the Nixon administration, found is that using get tough rhetoric and racially charged rhetoric that appeals to the, you know, and triggers the worst racial stereotypes that we have in America about the so-called underclass or undercaste works well politically. And this is true for politicians of all colors and of all political stripes. Throughout our history, we've seen that African Americans can play critical roles in existing caste systems. Today, you know, we've had an exponential increase, the quintupling of our prison population, primarily for nonviolent and drug-related offenses, the same types of crimes that occur with roughly equal frequency in middle-class white communities and on college campuses and universities and goes largely ignored.
I'm thinking, though, about the drug problem, drug dealing in Philadelphia, and it is in many ways associated with illegal guns, with violence. People living in these neighborhoods who are trying to raise families and send their kids to school talk about the kind of violence associated with drug dealing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we ought to be concerned about violent crime in these communities. But one misconception is that the drug war is aimed at rooting out violent offenders or drug kingpins. And that's just not true. From the outset of the war, federal funding has flowed to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost dramatically the sheer volume of drug arrests. It's a numbers game. State and local law enforcement agencies have been rewarded in cash through the Edward Byrne Memorial Grant Program for the sheer numbers of drug arrests, the numbers of people who are swept into the system. That's why police go out looking for the so-called low-hanging fruit, engaging in these stop-and-frisk operations in poor communities of color, ushering in people for minor possession offenses. In the 1990s, the period of the most dramatic expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, a drug less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood.
But don't these police officers also, though, bring a sense of law and order to a community as well? Or certainly are there to protect the people that don't want drug dealers in their neighborhood, for instance, or feel that they get targeted?
Listen, there's no doubt that communities that are suffering from high crime rates should have safety and security in their community and should have the police respond to violent crime in their communities. But again, and I can't stress this strongly enough, the drastic increase we've had in imprisonment in the United States has not been driven by violent crime or violent crime rates. Over the past 30 years, violent crime and crime rates generally have gone up and down. And today, as bad as they are in many places, are actually at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates have moved independently of one another. Regardless of whether crime is going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole, imprisonment rates have consistently soared. So what's going on in these communities is not simply law enforcement responding to crime or crime rates. No, it's law enforcement sweeping these communities, conducting stop and frisk operations of kids on their way to the school bus, on the way to the corner store, stopping and searching their cars. If this kind of law enforcement happened, these stop and frisk operations happened in middle-class white communities, the drug war would have ended 30 years ago. There would be outrage that young people were being stopped and frisked for no reason at all while they're just walking down the street. So these tactics and these sweep operations have boosted incarceration rates and ensured that the vast majority of people who are swept into the system for drug arrests are swept in for nonviolent, non-serious drug crimes.
And does also the expansion of the prison population, which of course has resulted in more prisons, also means employment for local communities across the country, whether you know, you're working as a guard in a prison or perhaps even working in the kitchen or in the nurse's office?
Absolutely. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs kicked off, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system could lose their jobs. Most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities, communities that are already vulnerable and teetering on the edge of economic collapse. Those prisons across America would have to close. Private prison companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits vanish. This system isn't going down, isn't downsizing to any significant degree without a major fight. That's why I firmly believe that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. And it's got to be a race-conscious movement, a movement that deals proactively and constructively with issues of race. Because any effort to downsize this system dramatically is going to be met with fierce resistance. And people who are trying to defend this system aren't going to argue, we should lock up millions of poor people so other people can have jobs and make a good return on their private investments. No, we will see a return to that racially coded, charged, get tough, crack down on them, those people kind of rhetoric and an uptick in media coverage of the, you know, quote unquote pathologies of the urban underclass. So we're going to have to deal with our racial divisions and anxieties if we're going to end mass incarceration.
That was my 2010 conversation with Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll hear my conversation with author Toni Morrison. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Toni Morrison has never been one to shy away from addressing some uncomfortable truths about life in America. She recently made some highly publicized remarks about the, quote, conversation about race during interviews on her new book, God Help the Children. Her remarks brought back memories of my 2003 interview with Morrison, in which she discussed her work, her life, and the ever-changing nature of race relations in the United States. So I thought we'd play some of that interview. Morrison had just published her book, Love, and read a passage that included these lines. It comforts everybody to think of all Negroes as dirt poor, and to regard those who were not, who earned good money and kept it, as some kind of shameful miracle. White people like that idea because Negroes with money and sense made them nervous. This excerpt of my interview begins with Morrison addressing this passage.
You know, when I was growing up, rich people had to explain themselves because we all understood that whatever they did, they probably got that money dishonestly. Mm. And it might be a form of denial, but I have to say that in those days you could be both poor and an adult at the same time. Now you can't. If you're poor now, you're a child.
Because you're treated like a child.
You're treated like a child. You're told where to live, where not to live. You're given food or food stamps. You're provided for, and you have no dignity whatsoever. It is as though it is your character flaw. And that was not the way people in my generation, who were also poor, grew up. Because you could do things to prove that you were an adult. You took care of your family. You could build a shack. You could, I don't know, fish. You could do things that suggested adulthood. And you were in control.
Are you saying, I mean, this is more, I guess, political, sociological question, but are you saying that the safety net, the war on poverty, all these programs to help poor people has turned poor people into children?
No. People need help in many instances. And before the so-called safety net, there were other people. There were neighbors, there were churches, there were other people who, without being asked, would step in. I'm not saying the safety net has stressed that. The neighborhoods have shifted. There really aren't any blocks left in many places like that. So that why not have the government provide the kinds of things that human beings used to do willy-nilly? And also there were a lot of people who fell through the net, so to speak, who just never made it, where the collapse was just devastating and it didn't have to be that way.
I wonder, too, and this is not to bring back segregation, certainly, but some have said that in the days of segregation, you would look at a neighborhood and it was just so diverse that you had teachers and doctors and economists living side by side with people who hadn't finished high school.
True.
And that there was a kind of vibrancy that's really missing.
Everybody
today.
Went to the same barbershop. You knew each other. And the neighborhood was close. The community was close. And you knew things that you would not know when you dispersed into other places. That's a valuable thing. But on the other hand, well, it's the kind of thing that every group that came to this country had to figure out. What was valuable about walking into the mainstream and so-called climbing, and what you lost in terms of your culture, your own language, for example, some of the other habits. And African Americans went through the same thing, just, you know, belatedly, where there were some marvelous freedoms that we were able to achieve. But at the same time, like anything else, it has a cost. My position is I just dislike the either-or situation. Why do you have to have only integration, forced integration, or acceptable integration, and to deplete all black schools? Why can't you have both? One does in terms of private colleges, but it could have been a little broader, I think.
You grew up in a town in Ohio called Lorain?
Yes.
Yeah. Was this an integrated town or?
Oh, what? Yeah. I thought the world was like that.
Really?
Where there were Polish people and Czech people and Mexican people and black people. Our connection was that we were all poor. But as far as race and ethnicity, it was a huge mix. I mean, it's one high school in that town. Where we went, there were separations, religious ones. You know, there were churches and, you know, societies for each of those ethnic groups. But in the streets and in the stores, I've never lived in a black neighborhood or never lived in a street in which there were no white people or other people. When I left and went to Washington, D.C. in the 50s, it was a huge alteration in my concept of how people lived in this country.
Was that your first experience with this thing about race and racism? And
it was in that sense, in the legal sense, right, where you had four colored-only signs on the public transportation in Washington, D.C., and where there were places downtown where you could not go. What I remembered are the places where, as a young black girl and my classmates, were able to go to certain restaurants because we knew we could use the facilities there. and everybody. It was like an underground railroad. You knew the one or two places where they wouldn't put you out.
And since we're talking a little bit about your growing up, your parents, it sounded like you came from a family of readers and also a family of storytellers. And,
oh, very
and even
much.
Ghost stories.
Oh, especially, mm-hmm. ghost stories. Those are always the best kind. They were rural people in their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother, my great-grandmother and on my mother's side, and that's the way we entertained ourselves.
Pre-TV, right? So what you would, I mean, I'm trying to imagine, sit around the kitchen table or the dining room table and tell stories.
At any time of day, they told them. And then the interesting thing, I think, for me, is that we were asked to tell them. So we would repeat stories, and they would listen very carefully at our delivery. We could change them a little bit, alter them a little bit, emphasize them a little bit. But we were called upon to do that kind of thing at a very early age.
Interested in what you were saying about thinking, I guess, in a sense, thinking large, thinking beyond the sort of day-to-day humdrum of life. Is that something that you've always done, or is that something you've come to with age, and whether there's a certain kind of freedom to think so expansively?
I think I always did from a very young age. I thought everybody did. And it was interesting to me, even as a young teenager, to realize that some people thought of their lives as very small. Small in feeling, and wasn't so wide as it was deep. And then as I, you know, grew up, I understood more about the restrictions and the necessities for sacrifice and hard work and so on. But nevertheless, life itself was just this interesting, extraordinary, and always surprising event, one after the other. And of course, as I grow older, I feel that profound kind of liberation that I certainly didn't feel when I was in my 30s and 40s, when I can make mistakes.
And it's okay.
And it's all right.
But was that something your parents gave you, this sense of as you say, feeling things largely, deeply?
Yeah. My mother, I think, especially. She was a very shrewd, realistic, hardworking woman. But she looked at the world as though it were there for her. Unlike my father, who was overwhelmed with the consequences of racism in his own life, my mother just judged everybody one person at a time. Hmm. And her first gesture was always open. And if she ended up not liking you, it wasn't because she didn't give you a large chance to do the best. And she found people's lives interesting. Not in that gossipy way, but kind of a shaped way. Hmm. And I think that's what was passed along to us, to her children.
And she had a good singing voice, too,
yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah, she was a fabulous singer.
Sang in church, sang
at home, you know, played the piano, as many of them did in my family. They never could read music, but they were sort of instinctive.
I read a quote, and this is really about writing, and you early on you said, when I first began to write, I was a little breathless because I wasn't sure that a particular expression or sensibility would be there tomorrow, and one can panic under those circumstances. Then you learn that, yes, you may forget the perfect sentence you thought it in a traffic jam. It may not come back, but then you realize it doesn't matter because a better one will come. I would think realizing that as a writer has got to be so liberating.
Oh, yeah. It's very hard to get that across to students. They think they're trained, the first shot is the best. But revision and rethinking that's the biggest part of it. But in the first book, I was clutching every clever or what I thought was beautiful or well-turned phrase and in a panic when I lost it. And then I had to find something else. But the process of finding something else meant, first of all, you had the confidence that it would be there, and it was. And more often than not, it was much, much better than the one you had been, you know, clutching and hanging on to and trying to remember. It's an important part of the art process to know that.
Well, and I wonder, too, because you worked as an editor, whether that's something that you also learned, because editors have to tear things apart and rework language and toss things out and be, I guess, tough on a writer that's so married to their language.
Well, in many instances, particularly novices sometimes, some people don't need that. They have really good eyes for their own work. But often the problem is to pull the writer away from what he loves. And the slogan or the word in editing is, if they love it, throw it out.
Oh, really?
Probably it's a very subjective, ill-placed. I've had moments like that in which my editor says, I would say, he would, you know, sort of doubt the clarity or the work in two or three sentences. And I would defend them and say, no, this is pure whatever.
It's perfection.
It's perfection. And he would say, yeah, but it's not hers. It's yours.
Oh.
You know, when your own voice slips into your character's voice and you force their language to become yours and you're not speaking the character's language, you're speaking your own. Those instances are rare, but they do happen. And sometimes you don't see it because you just love the way you said it. You love your own language. And that has got to be, you know, it leads you into an area that can only breed tears when you begin to just love it for its own sake. That's bad.
Well, and you've, Robert Gottlieb, I assume, is the editor that you're talking about. And he's been your editor for some time now, right?
Yeah.
And that must be such an interesting relationship, a long-term relationship between a writer and their editor.
That is special when you have what is really the right editor for you. It may not be the right editor for somebody else. And it's a question, I think he put it best. He said, we read alike.
And as an editor yourself, I'm curious about how you nurtured, I guess, writers that you thought had talent, and then what you say to ones that maybe have one book and maybe that's it, or just don't have what it takes. Is that?
Well, some people have one book and that's all they have, but maybe that's enough.
Yeah.
You don't have to write just because you can. And there are others who are probably not going to be. Those I don't really see because you can reject them right away.
Right.
The difficulty is in when you have students who are in and you have to do something, and even though they don't expect to be professional writers, they're in there to learn something. And that's when the editing that I had done comes in, because I can line edit their work word by word by word and teach them the value of reflection and rewriting and revision. But, yeah, you're in a position where you say no and you critique constantly. But the trick is to do it in such a way that it's always about the work and never about the worker.
Oh, interesting. Do you like all parts of this process then?
All of it.
The writing, the rewriting, the editing.
The manufacturing.
Do you?
Oh, yeah, the paper.
Really?
They won't let me do that now that I'm only an author. But when I was in publishing, oh, that, you know, interior design, book design, fabric.
You down there?
Oh, I love it.
Can I ask you something? Because you were born with a different name. Chloe Anthony Wofford was the name that you were born with. Does anyone still call you Chloe?
Oh, yeah.
In your family?
Oh, yeah. They all do. My nieces, my sister. And I always know who those, if somebody says Chloe, they're either one, somebody who knew me a long, long time, or they're those hideous telemarketers who've been looking at, you know, the phone book or something. Hi, Chloe. Hang up right away.
So I guess a Nobel Prize doesn't keep the telemarketers away, does it?
No, it doesn't.
but you changed it because I guess Chloe was an unusual name in the 50s?
People misspelled it, mispronounced it. And when I was a freshman in college, somebody began to call me Tony, and I thought, oh, that's great. We'll just leave it like that. Although I have to tell you, I was really miserable because I didn't change it on my first book. I really never planned to have Toni Morrison on the book. And I was just had come into editing, just got this book done, and I was going to use Chloe, and I was going to use my maiden name, Wofford. And I thought that would be not even a nom de plume, it would be my real name. And then the name in editing was Toni Morrison. Mm. And I sent it off, and life went on, and the Library of Congress cataloged it. And I thought it was too late, but it wasn't, but I thought so.
Yeah, but Toni Morrison works,
so
too,
it
I
works.
Guess.
That's the nom de plume.
That's your nom de plume. You've written books with one of your sons.
Yes.
Slade?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Slade.
Books for children.
Oh, that was a trip. I had written two books based on his comments when he was a kid. And then together we got excited about rewriting Esau, updating it, making it sort of pertinent, and getting rid of those terrible morals that were at the end of those stories. And particularly, he was incensed about the ant and the grasshopper. Mm. Why were they upset about the grasshopper? He was an artist. He was a musician. Why wasn't he worthy of getting help? So, but the relationship is wonderful that we have, but it was tough.
Well, I know you've written a libretto for an opera, Margaret Garner.
Yes.
Yeah, based on this beloved character, right?
Yeah. I was attracted to doing it, although I normally don't like to go back over because topics that I've exhausted. But Richard Daniel Poor wanted to do it based on the historical Margaret Garner as opposed to the one that I sort of plundered for my novel. But the other thing that was interesting to me was I think there are too few operas that sound right or good or beautiful in English. We generally hear them in other languages where they're terrific, or they're translated into English and we don't really care because the music is so gorgeous. But when you read the libretti by itself, it's very disappointing. So I thought if I could do the language of these people in language that is vernacular but beautiful and poetic, not Porgy and Bess, that language sounds awful to me. The music is great. The opera is great. I mean, the opera. But when you, Bess, you is my, I mean, what? Sorry about that. But I wanted to work in another, you know, arena and make it sound beautiful.
We just heard my interview with Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison, conducted in 2003 following the publication of her book, Love. Her new novel is God Help the Children. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll listen to my conversation with vocalist and conductor Bobby McFerrin. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We'll now take a listen to my interview with vocalist and conductor Bobby McFerrin. The musician is best known for the 1988 song Don't Worry, Be Happy. But his abilities and storied career extend far beyond that lighthearted novelty hit. He's collaborated with the ranks of Yo-Yo Ma, Chick Corea, and the Vienna Philharmonic. He cemented a reputation as a world-class vocal improviser. He joined me in the WHYY studios 5 years ago to discuss his album Vocabularies, a collaboration with vocalist Roger Treese. Let's listen. You were kind of tuning up your voice before we went on the air, were you?
I do.
You do that?
I've been known to erupt into song.
Oh, we love that.
At the drop of a hat. Yeah, it happens.
We love
quite
that.
Often. Yeah.
You sing soprano, alto, tenor, and bass.
Yeah.
When did you realize you had, what, a four-octave range?
I didn't know it at first. When I recognized that I was a singer, you know, I could sing, and I was singing when I was growing up. I sang in church choir when I was a kid and all. But I never thought of myself as a singer. And once that was in place, you know, I remember walking home from a dance class that I was accompanying at the University of Utah in 1977, and all of a sudden, I realized that I was a singer, and I actually started working right away. I called up a local hotel in town, and I got a gig the very next day.
So you realized, walking on the street, I, Bobby McFerrin, am a singer?
I'm a singer, that's right. And I spent maybe the first year of that trying to figure out what kind of singer I wanted to be. And the idea of being a soloist, being on stage by myself without a band and without any kind of accompaniment, whether on tape or, you know, guitar, piano, whatever, really got a hold of me. And it's a direct link to Keith Jarrett's solo piano playing. So when I decided to be a singer, when I recognized that that's what I was, I wanted to do that. I could see myself on stage alone, but I couldn't hear it. So I spent 6 years listening to what I was seeing and trying, you know, putting it all together. And I figured out that I had to come up with some kind of a technique that would allow the listener to hear things that I wasn't singing. They had to fill in the blanks.
I'm interested, too, and I don't know if it's possible to describe, when especially singing and improvising, sort of what's happening in your brain. Are you sort of dissecting your performance as you're singing, or are you sort of just trying to be in the moment?
I'm in the moment, and I've gotten to the point in my technique. I'm so confident in my technique, or I rest well in my technique, that I can actually follow things. I'm actually following music as it comes out. So I'm observing it. I'm not forcing it or, you know, trying to make it do something. It took me a long time to get to that because in the beginning I was making myself sing. I was singing louder. I was more forceful. I think I might have even been a little bit more limited in my ideas or places to go, you know. And I was a little intimidated by the audience, too. So it made me sing a little bit more. I was a little bit confined in my own technique, you know. But after doing it for years and years and years now the stage is my second home. It's a platform for adventure. I'm very relaxed on stage, extremely relaxed.
Do you do certain things to get ready before you go perform?
Just very, very simple things. Like I like to get to the hall at the very last possible moment because I don't like being there pacing back and forth in my dressing room or
with minutes to spare, so
I like if the show's at 8, you know, I like to get there about 7:58.
Oh, and I bet the people who run the place
love me for that. Yeah, right. But I let them know, you know, I said I like to get here at the last moment. I usually, you know, ask God to give me some ideas. You know, I'm depending on you, God, to help me get through tonight, you know, because I do recognize that this is a gift that I have and I need to take care of it, and I also need to honor the fact that it is a gift. So I do acknowledge God before I walk out and say, help me here, you know. And I sit down on my chair and I'm helped. You know, I open up my mouth and I'm helped.
You're the son of Robert McFerrin.
Yes, I'm junior. Yes.
Junior, exactly. Senior opera singer, the first African-American soloist with the Metropolitan
Opera. That's correct, yes. He signed a contract with the Met in 1955. I think his first role was in Faust. And then he did Rigoletto. I think I was about 6 when my sister and I went to see him do Rigoletto by Giuseppe Verdi. But my dad would say Joe Green. That's what his,
was that his humor?
Yeah, that was his humor. And yeah, pretty extraordinary. Yeah, I grew up in this wonderful musical home, you know, because it was full of classical music, but it was full of church music, gospel music, spirituals, African music, jazz. And then I grew up in the 60s, and so, you know, you turn on the radio and you've got Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66 and the Carpenters and Marvin Gaye and James Brown, and everything was all mixed up. They didn't have, you know, 60 stations and 70 stations like they have now. It was all on one station. Really extraordinary. Even Christian music and movie themes, oh my goodness.
It's all there. What
a feast. It was fantastic.
And your mother was a singer and sister as well?
And sister, right, yeah.
So were you destined to be a singer?
I guess so, and I guess that's one of the reasons that it took me so long, because everybody else was doing it, you know. And I was a pianist, at least I thought I was. Mm. That was my instrument of study in college, and I played piano in bands, and I thought I was a pianist, but I kept having this nagging suspicion that I wasn't a pianist, that I was something else.
And that day then you walked down the street and you said, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I am a singer. I am a singer.
And I've seen you perform. I mean, what you bring is this very playful approach. I mean, I guess part of improv is playing.
Is play, yeah. Well, you know, when you're a music student, your teacher says, ready, set, play. And I took that, I took that literally. Play. It's time to play. And I think music should also be a joyful experience. And I think that, you know, if I have any kind of an agenda, it's to make people joyful, to feel the joy that I feel singing, because I get a lot of joy out of it.
I mean, truly, for you, your voice is an instrument. I mean, we hear people say that the voice is an instrument, but it doesn't always sound that way. It sounds like a voice.
It sounds like a voice. Well, I think my dedication to working with the color palette of the voice has a lot to do with that, and working with dancers has a lot to do with it, because when I first started doing solo concerts, I had to learn how to use my body, to let my body be free and flexible and loose and relaxed, you know, because it used to be in the beginning that I would leave the stage stiff, you know, and I couldn't understand why. And finally working with dancers, they would say, well, you've got to loosen up a little bit, you know.
Literally, just be loose on stage
and let the music come out of your body. You know, think of your body as the instrument.
And you use your body as well.
I do.
For percussion.
Percussion. And it also helps show sound. Sometimes I'll use my hands in a way that helps the audience to actually hear the sound better. They can see it. You know, so I'm giving them a visual component.
Can you do that on the radio for us?
No.
You can do it for me.
I can do it for you.
I'm curious, though, and you have collaborated with lots of different people, what you look for when you are collaborating with somebody else.
Someone that's going to take me out of myself, you know, bring me into a place that I wouldn't go there normally on my own. That happens occasionally, not so much as in the beginning, but when I work with Chick Corea, you know, it still happens.
As you mentioned, as you've gotten older, your voice has changed. It's a little softer.
Yes.
Do you feel like you have... Do you have less wind, or is
No.
it you're just using it in a different kind of way?
It's gotten down to the level of my speaking voice. You know, it's not a different voice. It's the same voice. My speaking voice and my singing voice are the same. You know, it's not, you know, I become a singer at 8 o'clock.
Right.
You know, and when I'm doing workshops, I try to encourage the students to not think of themselves as, you know, performers when they're on stage. They should have the same voice and the same attitude that they have when they get up in the morning and they take their shower and they're walking down the street and they're standing in line at the bank or at the bus stop, you know, the same voice that they have when they got their blue jeans on and when they turn around and put on their formal wear because they're doing an 8 o'clock performance. So it's got to be the same voice. Honest, plain, regular, naive.
Naive.
Yeah. Just, you know, a person who's doesn't know, who's willing to learn while they're performing on stage, while they're singing on stage, not performing, but singing on stage.
So don't be a know-it-all?
Don't be a know-it-all. Yeah, exactly.
So, and I don't want to put you on the spot here, but so if you could sing an answer to my question, it would be sort of in that same voice that you're using right now. So if
it
I said,
would be
what
in the same voice that I'm using when I'm speaking. See, it's the same voice. You know, speaking, singing.
So when you're walking around, do you just have that stuff in your head all the time?
It comes out, yeah. It just comes out.
And are you listening? I mean, listening to conversations, listening to music, traffic, birds?
Everything becomes material for a piece. Someone will just say, you know, I'll ask how someone is, and they'll say, oh, I'm feeling great. And then, you know, anything will come out.
So when you're getting ready for a concert and it is improv, it's not like you're going out there completely blind, right? I mean, you have a bit of a game plan?
The only game plan that I have is the first two pieces are improvised. So that can take anywhere.
A blank slate.
That's a blank slate, yeah. So when I walk out and sit down, I open up my mouth, and I'm committed to the first ideas to come out. Whatever comes out first, I'm committed to it. So I explore that for a while, and that could take 15, 20 minutes. And then it turns out that the hardest piece for me to do in any given night was the second piece. So I decided to make that an improv also. I don't know why that is. So
it's a transition from maybe it's a certain kind of mindset.
It could be. Yeah.
I'm thinking of all those people that were told, well, you don't have a singing voice. You can't sing. Are you sort of railing against that?
Yeah. I don't rail against it because in some instances it's true. There's
right.
some
it's
people
just
who
I cannot it's, sing.
There's
right?
some people who just cannot sing.
And I'm trying to imagine you as we're, you and I are about the same age. So in the 1960s, did you have bands that you were part of?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was in the first band that I played with was a group called The Fascinations, T-H-E-E. Mm-hmm. I went to a predominantly Latin American high school, and most of the bands that came out of in the 60s in Latin America had The in front of, you know, so I was with The Fascinations, and then I played with The Viscounts.
Wow.
I was 14 in The Fascinations.
Playing piano?
Playing piano, right. Playing, actually, Hammond organ. And then organist with a group called The Viscounts. And we entered a Battle of the Bands contest, and out of 50 bands, we came in third. So that's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
You know. And then I put together a jazz group called the Bobby Mack Jazz Quintet. You know, it was guitar, bass, drums, piano, and saxophone.
Wow. And you studied composition in college?
I studied composition in college, yeah.
With the idea that you would be a pianist?
Well, you know, I was thinking that I wanted to do films, TV shows, commercials, anything. And my hero was Dave Grusin, who was my hero. And I've got to say something about Dave. This is an extraordinary man because when I was a 19-year-old college student, Dave Grusin was my hero. His name was on everything. Albums, arranging, you know, for this artist and that artist, and TV themes, It Takes a Thief, and movies, and it was everywhere. And I wanted to be like Dave Grusin. And I found his phone number in the Musicians Union book, and I gave him a call, and a woman answered the phone. I thought it was assistant, or could have been his assistant or secretary or whatever. She explained to me that Dave was working on a film at Paramount Studios, and she'd take a message. So anyway, as far as I was concerned, that was that. You know, he was too busy to call. Anyway, you know, 3 days later, he actually called me.
He called you back.
He called me back and invited me to his studio where he was working. He said, bring your compositions. Let me take a look at them. So I put on my best suit. I remember I got all dressed up.
You probably had one,
right? I had one. I put on a suit. Went down to his studio. He looked at my compositions. He was working on a film score called Tell 'Em Willie Boy Is Here with Robert Redford, Paramount. And he took me to the session, introduced me to all the musicians, and we became friends. He would look at my compositions and give me some ideas. And we've been friends to this day. I was 19 years old when we met.
And he never met you before?
He never met me before, never heard any of my stuff, nothing. I was just a complete stranger to him. So ever since that, then, whenever anyone would send me a CD or a tape or something, I would make sure that I did everything that I could to respond because of I recognize how important it was for me. So I think it's good to pass it on.
Do you get sent a lot of
stuff? Oh, my
stuff?
Goodness. I have to. I can't respond to everyone, you know, but when I have a chance to listen to something and they do leave their phone number, I do give them a call.
Now, you have three kids.
I have three children.
I'm looking at a picture of Taylor, who's a musician, yes?
Right, yeah. And my youngest, my daughter.
So do they influence you as a musician?
Oh, my goodness, yes, they do, because they bring to my attention things that I normally wouldn't find on my own. You know, I mean, they're out there in techno world.
Yes, they are.
Listening to everything. And they say, Dad, have you heard this? Have you heard that? You know.
I'm debating about whether to ask you about Don't Worry, Be Happy, but I know that was a song that launched
your career. Yeah.
We're not going to play it.
No, that's okay. You know, the thing that's really interesting about that tune, the story behind it is when I was a kid, one of the things that I would do to help me remember the answers to quiz was to make up a song. You know, so if it was the United States capitals or different countries, I'd make up a song that would have the answers to the quiz, so it would help me to remember. It was a, you know, memory device. And I was walking down the street in New York City. I see this poster that says, Don't Worry, Be Happy. And I start singing, Don't Worry, Be Happy. And when I got into the studio, I wrote out the lyrics. And you know, it took me about an hour and a half, maybe to do all of it. I had previously decided to take a sabbatical because I had been touring a lot and I was really, really tired. So just as Don't Worry is taking off and flying out the stores and selling, you know, millions of copies, and I'm getting all these requests to do all these TV shows and all this publicity and stuff, I said no because I was tired. And so the song, all on its own, without any help from me, without any promotion whatsoever, took off all on its own.
So
it's amazing.
You thank that song for
I do indeed.
Keeping you
yeah, it's still working.
You going.
It's still working. It's put all my kids through college.
We close out my 2010 interview with Bobby McFerrin with a song called Baby, the lead track off its collaboration record with vocalist Roger Treese called Vocabularies. McFerrin is currently on tour. And that does it for this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Send us an email and tell us what you think of the show, whyy.org/Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. Thanks for listening.